Welcome to episode number 15 of the School of Success podcast series with a seriously gifted Chicago-based psychotherapist and trauma and relationship expert, Ryan Green. Welcome to the School of Success podcast series. My name is Melanie Pritchard, former lawyer turned success coach and corporate well-being trainer. And each month, we bring you an inspiring person and message to help you discover the tools for creating happiness in the widest sense. Peter Levine said, "The paradox of trauma is that it has both the power to destroy and the power to transform and resurrect." Sharon Salzberg said, "Someone who has experienced trauma also has gifts to offer all of us. In their depth, their knowledge of our universal vulnerability, and their experience of the power of compassion." Ryan himself said, "People that have experienced childhood trauma are not doomed to fail in adult relationships." Ryan also wrote, "Spouses of trauma survivors are called to love ferociously. The growth they experience is their benefit, and real intimacy with the survivor is worth the wait." I have a very special guest on today's podcast episode, Ryan Breen, whose mission it is to cut through the psychobabble of our culture and support both individuals and couples facing challenges including divorce and other crises relating to childhood trauma, addiction, and infidelity. I first came across Ryan when I was fortunate to stumble upon an outstanding article he wrote for the Good Men Project entitled "Married to Trauma, Loving a Victim of Childhood Trauma." The article moved me so much that I went on to have therapy with him to better understand some pretty complex relational dynamics that I was facing in times past. Ryan has been featured across a range of publications, including Psychology Today, Hello Love, The Good Men Project, and Medium. He writes beautifully on a range of subjects, including the mental health of children, why therapy is not always the answer, narcissism and how to break out of toxic cycles, and how to navigate relational issues involving trauma. In today's episode, we will be exploring why experiencing conflicts is so important in relationships, the difference between trauma with a big T and trauma with a little t, what codependency is and why it can be fatal to healthy relationships, why good parenting is essential to a child's mental health, and the importance of boundaries in relationships. We will also be discussing why suffering can be a deeply valuable practice and what narcissism really is. Finally, we'll be busting through some myths around what success in relationships really looks like. I hope you're as excited as I was to be joined by the one-off talented Ryan Breen. So without further ado, let me introduce you to the one, the only, Ryan Breen. Ryan, I'm delighted to have you here on the School of Success podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, delighted to have you here. So, I first found Ryan when I was reading a fascinating and brilliant article that he had written on trauma. And I was amazed by his eloquence and how beautifully he wrote on probably one of the most complicated subjects in the world. So thank you, Ryan. I loved your article.
Thank you.
So Ryan, why don't you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Okay. My name is Ryan Breen. I am a psychotherapist and relationship coach in Chicago. that's my primary sort of identity, I guess, professionally. Working mostly with couples who are in sort of high conflict situations, and particularly dealing with one partner has some significant trauma in their background that seems to be impeding their ability to get on relationally. Also work a lot with individuals who are in relationships with individuals who they're struggling to understand and struggling to create connection with, again, because of trauma. So really focused on how relationship plays into, committed long-term relationships, and then also helping people who are in those situations get out of them when they need to, because it can be kind of, it can be abusive.
Right. Wow, so many, as I would call, sexy buzzwords in there. You probably have so many tips that you could help us all with around relationships, Ryan.
We'll see.
Amazing. So that's interesting. So you said that you work with couples sometimes where like one person has experienced significant trauma, like in their background. Could you tell us a bit more about like what kind of traumas people go through, like what trauma is?
Well, it's a tough word to talk about because it is a buzzword. Like you said, I think we've all, because of social media and because of the internet, we've all become sort of armchair psychologists. And we hear these words like trauma and narcissism and codependence, and we self-diagnose and we diagnose our loved ones. And it can become a slippery slope. Some might say that we all experience some level of trauma in childhood. So we have to distinguish whether we're talking about sort of what they would call big T trauma, which are some significant, real significant events of abuse and neglect that we all know, sexual abuse, physical abuse, flat out sort of neglect, narcissistic parent, inability to attach, versus, certain things that can be traumatic, and not to downplay them, but, divorce, more common things, parent who might have, maybe drink too much, wasn't quite there for them, that kind of, stuff is normal. I think everybody does experience on that level. There's good enough parenting, and then there's, and that's even comes with its own flaws. But primarily the issue though falls in line with people that have experienced like complex childhood trauma, where it was a persistent, ongoing, chronic pattern of sort of neglect or abuse that carried on into, adolescence and into adulthood. So
interesting. So, you mentioned with trauma, you said it can be like abuse or neglect, physical, sexual. And then you spoke about good parenting. Well, what about the emotional like stuff? Like, what do you ever deal with people who haven't been like physically abused or sexually abused? But like, just so people understand, like, what would sort of being a subpar parent in terms of like providing emotionally look like?
Yeah, Good enough parenting is consistent parenting. So, before we get into techniques or like things that your parents did or didn't do, one of the things that a child needs in development is they need a consistent environment. Mm-hmm. They need to know how to predict their organism, their brain is needing the environment to help regulate itself. And so it's trying to organize itself around what is normal. And when normal is consistently changing with ups and downs, where today mom and dad or mom is really, really happy and loving and everything else, and tomorrow she's angry and putting me off, and that continues in a pattern over the course of the first few years of my life, particularly, my system's going to develop some anxiety. It's going to become trigger prone, if you will, because I'm always going to be on guard. I'm going to be more hypervigilant. And then when someone walked into my life at a later time, I become triggered and reactive and self-protective. In a sense, that's generally speaking how that works.
Yeah, it makes so much sense when you say it, Ryan. You unpack it so well. Trigger sensitive, trigger prone. What kind of things do you notice? Obviously, you work with a lot of individuals, couples. What kind of things might trigger someone who's experienced a traumatic childhood?
Well, the triggers are related to sort of how they experienced it. And most of those triggers are buried deep in their sensory experience, right? It's more sensory stuff. It's physical and it's emotional. And so it can just be, somebody didn't show up and meet my expectations. My spouse came home you know, a half hour late, or, you know, wanted to go to the gym. And when they left, I felt like it was going to be, you know, like it's a big deal, like they re-experience abandonment in small day-to-day things. And the issue isn't whether I feel triggered or not. The issue is that when I'm triggered, my response emotionally is, you know, an 8 or a 9 on the scale of 1 to 10, when the event itself is something as simple as I'm going to go to the gym and I'll be back in an hour. And, right. and those kind of things become, you know, points of contention.
Yeah.
So the reactions are too strong for the relationship to actually, you know, work through the issue.
Right. Well, you're so eloquent. That was so well put. And I guess, you know, obviously you're really well versed in trauma. Obviously that's your job, but I suppose a lot of people wouldn't be able to unpack that. Let's say they're dating someone who was traumatized and who was seemed really triggered, like you said, an 8 or a 9. Like, how does one deal with that if they know nothing about trauma? Like, how does that like show up for your clients? How do people cope with that?
Yeah, I think the clients that show up in counseling or for coaching are people that tend to lean towards that sort of more codependent side. They're trying to figure out, how do I relate to this person? How do I make this person feel better or feel love? It's a genuine concern and desire to relate. The problem is, though, is that person's reaction is such a projection, and they don't want to get in touch with, nor are they sometimes aware that it actually is the trauma. They're so externalized in their behavior. Mm-hmm. And so that partner needs to learn to set boundaries, because they need to learn to say, wait, I'm not crazy. This actually is an overreaction.
Yeah.
I can't even attend to your need while you're raining down emotion and all this sort of rage and or shutting down on me. There is no sort of relationship in those situations. And so I have to first recognize that that's what I'm dealing with. And most of the clients that I'm talking to are coming in really thinking that they can find the way to communicate with somebody who's having that issue. And oftentimes what the reality of it is that they need to set boundaries and sort of hope that person sort of wakes up to the dynamic change in the relationship or get out of the relationship because that person has to deal with that trauma sort of individually and bring that into the conversation. And if they're talking about it and they're taking responsibility for how trauma has affected them and they're willing to bring it to the table, then there's a chance.
Okay. Well, I felt like a surge of like hope when you said that. There's a chance if people are willing to talk about it and take responsibility for it. So it's not like a death sentence. Yeah. It's not like, oh, you're traumatized, you're screwed, you can't do relationships, that's it. It doesn't have to be like that.
Right. There, I mean, I think there's always redemption. I think, what is it going to take for that person to sort of wake up to their own issue? Again, understandably, if I've been victimized, I'm in a position of sort of perpetual victimization or powerlessness. Everything's happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
So like that's how I experienced the world. I had no control. Everything's happening to me, and so that's how I continue to see the world, and that's the lens I see things through. So when my partner makes a mistake or gets upset or has their own emotions, I get defensive of that because it's as if I'm re-experiencing the trauma or the weight. It's a sort of reenactment that's happening in me. And now I have to defend myself against you and your normal mistake or emotion.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's sort of backwards. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Which kind of makes it sound, because it sounds so easy when we hear phrases like, oh, just take responsibility, you know, talk about things. It sounds very normal adult behavior, right? Adults take responsibility. But when you explain it like that, it sounds like kind of walking up Mount Everest and struggling with the lack, you know, with the lack of oxygen. Like, that must be so hard if it reminds you of something that's deeply triggering from your childhood.
Yeah. It's a huge weight. And I think too that, you know, it's not so much that, and how do I put this? It's the issue within a relationship is that the issue isn't like we're talking about trauma and we're rationalizing it, we're conceptualizing it, sort of diagnosing it, we're explaining a behavior that we see and we're bringing it down to this diagnostic sort of level so we can go, okay, that's what that is. The problem is that the issue itself is not rational. So you can't explain to somebody, you can't tell somebody that this, that, you know, you have trauma, you need to go deal with that, you're affecting the relationship. That itself is an attack. That itself is something that's going to make them feel defensive. The system is so wired. We're talking about a sort of neurobiological system that is wired to react. So the rational brain essentially doesn't have the authority that it should have in that person's system, because they're so limbic, as like Bessel van der Kolk would say, they're limbic. So their system is sort of always wired, and that system takes over the brain. So we're no longer thinking rationally and considering things. We are reacting and defending.
Right.
And that's, it's impossible to have a relationship in that situation.
Yeah. Limbic. And there's a, what's the limbic brain for people who don't know anything about the brain?
I mean, the limbic system is essentially this combination of like our reactive, self-protective, you know, the amygdala, the fight or flight system, and sort of our relational attachment brain, that are kind of working at a deeper level and a subconscious level below our sort of cognitive brain, which is our thinking and rational abilities.
Wow.
And so that becomes reactive because it's hypersensitive. It's hypersensitive to trauma because, of course, the limbic system and the amygdala is designed for protection. So it learns and gets coded by things that have hurt us in order to prevent us from having to experience that again. And so everything that resembles the trauma that I experienced, everything that resembles it, is going to alarm me. And all of a sudden it's gonna take off and fight or flight kicks in, and there's no, you know, I have to now soothe myself in order to be able to get the rational brain back online.
Gosh, fascinating.
So a lot of partners that I'll talk to, a lot of people that I'll talk to are, they want me to talk to their partner. They want to find out, what can I say, what can I do, and the issue is less about what can I say or do in relationship to that person. I have to find out, in some ways, we have to see that your need to set boundaries is your need to grow. Their need to deal with their trauma is their need to grow. And those two things are working against each other in relationship. And so how do I extract, you know, one or two individuals from the relationship so they can see and observe the dynamic and how they're relating to that person? And oftentimes what it comes down to is the need to set boundaries, the need to realize that that's not my issue. I can't fix this person. I can't explain this to that person in order to fix them so we can be better together. I have to look at what I'm being called to do, and I have to do it. And that's really hard. The setting boundaries is really hard, you know, because it releases all the anxiety of my own sort of childhood trauma, my fear of rejection, my fear this person might leave me, you know, something like that. So
that is, I mean, so many people seem to struggle with boundaries. Could you tell us more about, like, because you've, I know we've spoken about boundaries before, and you're, again, very eloquent explaining that, like, what are boundaries and why are they helpful?
Well, I mean, I think boundaries are sort of the place where, I mean, we have to be, you know, we are individuals before we are in a relationship. And what happens is people get lost in the relationship. They're identifying with the relationship too much. And therefore my emotional system is sort of so tied to this relationship that I'm not okay if we're not okay, and we're not okay if you're not okay. So now I'm in this loop of thinking that my problem is solved by fixing something, some relationship in my life. And what I have to realize is that's not where my security has to come first. I have to find out what it is that I need. And what are my needs to grow? And not just what do I need in terms of like health, like go to the gym and have my own social life and have friends and hobbies, but like literally, what is this person triggering inside of me? Why am I so anxious and so needing to fix this situation? Why am I so preoccupied by this relationship? And when I answer that question in my own self, I find my own history. I find my own potential trauma and how I'm looking at relationships wrong and why I attract individuals like this in the first place. Now we can hone in on my need to grow, and my need to grow will be essentially my need to fix things is a compensation for something that I need to deal with. So I need to let my stuff come to the surface so I can deal with that. And that's hard, because now I have to set boundaries against, not against this person, but in relationship to this person. And let their stuff be their stuff.
Yeah.
And let my stuff be my stuff. So it's a real sorting out.
Sure is. It sounds like a really effective high level spring clean. Oh my gosh, amazing. And I remember you once saying something really powerful. You know, you said a minute ago, like, boundaries are scary because we risk someone kind of rejecting us, right? It's almost like the fixer suddenly has to assume the opposite identity of, like, I throw my hands up, this is your stuff, I'm not going to fix you. And that's, yeah, makes you vulnerable, I suppose. But I remember you once said something really powerful, Ryan, when we spoke before about boundaries pushing the truth to the surface. And I found that very profound.
I think, it's like raising the tension or raising the conflict. That, I always try to think about it like there's something that I'm avoiding in sort of confrontation with this person. It's scary. Again, I a lot of again, I don't want to be so general, but a lot of people that are in relationship to people that experience trauma are people who are sort of either caregivers by nature, a lot of oldest kids, or had a very dominating parent who kind of put them in their place. And so they kind of keep their own opinions down, and their own feelings are down, because my feelings are based off everybody else. Is everybody else happy? Okay, good. What do you want to have for dinner? I don't know. What do you guys want? Great, let's have it. That's fine. There's no real me coming to the table. And what has to happen is I have to start bringing that to the table and kind of having my own expectations. What do I want? What do I need? Maybe you're not the person that I should be with. Maybe this is not going to work, and maybe our relationship is built off sort of this toxic bond of codependency and narcissism, so to say, or the trauma bond kind of thing, versus two individuals who are showing up and able to help each other meet each other's needs in a sort of more balanced, supportive way. And I have to find that out, because I have to first determine, well, what do I want? What do I need? And I have to put that out there. And if that person won't provide it, that's going to ex I'm going to experience rejection. And that is a core wound of a lot of individuals who are on that codependent side of the spectrum, is they're avoiding rejection
Oh my gosh, that,
at their
yeah.
core.
So many fascinating things you said there, especially about, the dominating parent and sort of almost being like submissive, being used to not thinking about the I because you're always pleasing others.
Now, if I'm avoiding rejection, that now back to what I was talking about earlier. If I'm avoiding re if I identify that you're avoiding rejection and we're talking to an individual person, now I have to confront you with the need to go face your rejection, which is why this is so real. It's not a cognitive issue. I have to go put this into experiential practice and start going, okay, well, I'm going to go do this thing that I want to do. My partner might get mad at me. I mean, but again, their issue and their inability to resolve and talk and not have explosive, arguments is the bigger issue that has to be acknowledged, because there is no relationship if we don't do that. Everything then becomes codependent, and now it's I'm just catering to your feelings and your emotions.
Gosh, that was profound. There is no relationship if we do that. Like, if we're not really communicating our needs, it's kind of like a fake relationship in a way.
Because a relationship is really this is sort of this created space between two individuals. Like we should be coming into this thing and not just like operating on our roles, but we should be coming together and really experiencing, conflicts. And that's not even in a powerful way, but just little differences and nuances, and working out what does that mean in relationship to you? What does that mean about me? I need creative space in a relationship. If I can't be creative with you, then we don't have a relationship. We have a business agreement that might, at some point in time go bad because we're not transactionally satisfying each other. And that's and that and now we're not getting intimacy. We're not growing, and it becomes stale and stagnant at best.
And obviously you work with couples who I guess are struggling in some way, you'd assume. If you had to, probably might be a difficult question, but if you had to like guess the percentage of couples who are operating at subpar levels in terms of, we can all think of people where it's like you can tell that one party's scared to speak up or one party really dominates and they just keep the status quo because it's easier. Like, what percentage of people do you think actually operate at like healthy levels, would you guess? Like communicating their needs, having effective conflicts, boundary setting, all that good stuff.
Yeah, that's I would have a very skewed opinion, because I only I know some I have some friends that are I consider very healthy and balanced, and I admire them in their relationships and their marriages, and I've mentioned to them that it's my perspective is so skewed because I'm in I'm in conflict with people, in, you know, professionally speaking, I'm in conflict dealing and helping with people with their own conflict. So I see a very sort of negative side of it. So I don't know. I mean, I know they're out there, and those people don't come to therapy and they don't seek out help because they don't need it. So they're doing okay. So I don't know those people from a sort of professional lens, but I do think that if we look at like statistics like divorce, and we look at what's happening in the trends relationally with people, we see a lower level of commitment in relationships. So people aren't getting married as much. We see, you know, the divorce rate. So, I mean, I guess the thing you could say is, well, how many people out of the, you know, 50% or 48% or whatever it is statistically who are not getting divorced, what percentage of those are actually happy? So out of 100%, 50% are bad, they're getting a divorce. What percentage of the leftovers are actually healthy? And that it becomes a very, it's a sad state, I think, for most people in their relationships.
Yeah.
You know,
very interesting. And, makes sense. You know, you work with people who are obviously struggling in some way. And I think we probably all know people who you might assume, but they seem so great together. Oh, but you look so great on Facebook. And you just never really know, do you, what's going on behind closed doors. I have friends who are like, God, he or she is so different behind closed doors. And people are like, no, you're no way. Yeah. And they're like, no, really, you know, completely different. So I guess it's hard to say.
Right.
Yeah. You mentioned, Ryan, the word codependency. What does that mean exactly?
I mean, codependency, I kind of alluded to it, where basically my whole entire like identity is lost in other people. People pleasers tend to be, you know, codependent. It's that, and what it really means sort of at a deeper emotional level is that, again, I'm not okay if everybody else isn't okay. I'm not okay if I don't get everything and everybody else happy. And that's my whole identity is found in making other people happy. And again, it looks good socially. It looks good because people like those kind of people. They're helpful. They show up. They're loving. They care. But behind it is a real sort of self-serving nature. It's I'm actually helping you to help myself. And if I don't help you, if I say no, it's going to wake up that anxiety in me. So codependents tend to be overdoers, and then they don't feel appreciated on the back end of it sometimes. And then they get resentful because people aren't appreciating them for what they're bringing to the table, but they don't turn that motor off and realize that you can't be everything to everybody. And sometimes people have to deal with their own family. With kids, it's obviously, you know, your kids are upset. You should feel upset, but you also can't be lost so far, even in your kids, where if your kids are hurt or something bad happens to them, that it's like, I got to fix this for them. I have to take care of them. That's where you see it show up. And in some ways, parents are codependent, and they should be to a certain degree, but you know, there's still a line.
Absolutely. And when you say that, like parents, like a codependent to a degree, like how does that show up with most parents, would you say?
I mean, they have to be like, if your kids are going through something, you're not going to be able to like, just be like, oh, well, we'll just, you know, hopefully you'll get over it. Like, you know, you're going to feel something in relationship to that child, and your well-being and their well-being are sort of tied together, and that's healthy. But it becomes one of those things where letting go, where your 13, 14, 15 year old might need to deal with something. Might need to be a consequence that you have to let them deal with, and kind of have the attitude towards them like, well, you knew better, you didn't do it, and now you got to suck it up, as opposed to fixing it and taking care of it and telling them it's okay, things like that, where it's, you know, it's not, and that's reality, and that's life, and you know, teaching them to take responsibility.
That sounds like great parenting, Ryan. I feel like you should write a parenting manual. I'm sure lots of people would learn a lot. So like, if a parent was codependent, like what kind of so you said like they might try and fix things for their child. They might, What other, is there anything else that you might see as like symptoms of a codependent parent or a child who is subject to a codependent parent? What kind of behaviors might you see? I'm thinking of like people in my world here and their relationship with their parents and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the parents end up, you know, you see it a lot in our culture nowadays. You see a lot of the helicopter parenting. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of the, you know, I remember just even when my son was little, I noted that there was, you know, there's not a lot of kids playing outside anymore, unsupervised. Everything's a play date. Everything's a setup. We don't let kids sort of explore, and everything is sort of structured and scheduled and provided, and there's always this adult oversight, and then you see parents get really upset. I actually heard a story. A friend of mine was talking about her daughter had a sleepover, and the mother called up and we're talking about 15-year-old kids, like this is having a sleepover with like three kids, and the mother called and said, and asked them to make sure that their alcohol was put away. I don't even remember what else she asked, but she basically had the audacity to call and say, basically, if my daughter comes to your house, I need to know these things are happening.
Right.
And it was like, and again, that looks really good and concerning, over time, in some ways, but it's probably too much. And it's probably exemplifying a pattern of sort of control that parent is keeping on their kid.
Yeah.
By keeping them too safe.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
If that makes sense. So that would be an example of somebody who's very codependent, because that parent is overly worried and over concerned, and mm-hmm. that child's not gaining any independence.
Right. And if you come across like an adult who needs to sort of run to mom and dad for their opinion on everything, who they should marry, what they should be doing, like what might that show up?
I mean, you'll hear that in conversations. You hear people who are concerned about making big life decisions without their parents' approval.
Hmm.
And sometimes that, sometimes that's coming from a cultural background. Sometimes when you have people whose parents are like first generation immigrants, and they come from more of an Eastern culture, you're going to see way more of that sort of this, it's a community is more important than the individual. And they come to this, to like the US or whatever, and they're in this place where the individual is held up higher than the community to a fault, and both things happen to a fault, and they kind of confront themselves in our culture. But those individuals, you're wondering, well, again, what do you need in that situation? Well, you need to differentiate. You're an adult. You're 26. You're 30. You're 35. You need to make a decision here, and make a hard decision, and not break free from other people's approval. Again, it's other people's approval. What do you want? Let's identify that, and let's walk that out, and let's act it out against the fear. Let's face the fear. I mean, that's what it really comes down to.
Yeah. Well, fear is such a bitch, isn't it? It can really disable people, I've noticed. Oh, such a life hack, isn't it? How do you face fear and move through it?
Well, people need to realize that if they don't, they're already experiencing a degree of the alternative, which is the suffering they're already having, which is actually, one of the ways that someone put it to me before was, there's two kinds of suffering. Everyone's going to suffer. And there's two kinds of suffering. There's redemptive suffering, and then there's just suffering like for no purpose, where you're just hurting yourself over and over and over again, and you're trying to rationalize that, versus redemptive suffering, which is I'm taking the strain knowing that this is going to produce growth in me, kind of like going to the gym, exercising, things like that, I know there's a result because it's tied to a need to grow inside of me. And so I go put the work in, and it hurts, but I get stronger and better on the other end.
Oh my God, that was so well put. Redemptive suffering for the courageous.
Yeah. I mean, the courageous or faith filled, because it does require a certain element of that as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Growth. Yeah, I sometimes say, have to be careful how I say this, because it's not like I'm attracted to my male clients, but I've noticed that for me, it's been quite wonderful working with men who want to come to coaching. Precisely because, in a sense, they're embodying what you just mentioned. It's like, I'm struggling with this. It may be affecting me. It may be affecting my partner. And I'm willing to explore the stress that I'm feeling because I'm more committed to the growth. I don't want to stay the same. And I've learned something from working with men, because any kind of man I work with is open to kind of what you just described. And it's very inspiring to see. It's really inspiring and it feels very healthy to see that, because it's like sort of courage embodied.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the, first of all, every single individual, if we're not growing, we're in trouble, right? So we need to find out what that is. So there's always a need to grow. And again, and not to oversimplify it, but if you can find out what your need to grow is, or find out what a client's need to grow is, where is that core issue? What are they trying to get? What needs are trying to be met? You can identify that core need, that core fear, and then you can conceptualize that in the material world, in the objective world, and begin to address it. And create interventions that are going to drive that out. But they have to realize that that's a need. They have to realize that there's only two paths. There's avoidance, and then they go after it and get it. And so it's otherwise, yeah, there's no point. I think men like to be told more like, tell me what to do and I'll do it. Like, I know I need this. Let's do it. It's very, very practical and very, you know, it's easier because you give them one thing to do, they do it. The hard part is if they don't understand it. And I think the hardest part is getting people to understand what you're saying, as opposed to just what you're saying they should do. Because you have to understand this in order for you to carry this out. Otherwise, you'll do what I tell you one day, and then it'll fall apart, and you won't realize the principle at play is what you need to carry, not just the necessary specific intervention.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's partly why the article that you wrote, really, I was so impressed with it, because it felt like you really understood on a kind of deeply intellectual level, like you understood, you had the capacity to understand and therefore like hold space for others. And I mean, I hope I didn't speak out of turn saying this, but you know, some people stereotype like psychotherapists or therapists, and I don't need a therapist, you know, I don't need some whatever non-doctor telling me how I can develop. Is that something you've come across, Ryan, with men or with potential clients at all? In a sense, from your experience working with clients, what is it that tips the balance generally, that makes people think, okay, finally, I'm prepared to do something here. I'm prepared to get help.
Yeah, I think the threat of loss, a lot of times people are dealing with the traumatized individual is dealing with a big load of shame. And that shame is really it's their issue, and they're not dealing with that shame. And so they have to wake up to go deal with that individually, so that way they don't pour that onto the relationship and expect this person to be anything other than themselves.
Yeah.
When it shows up in the relationship, it's oftentimes what we're saying to them is, we do need to have individual therapy. Mm-hmm. And because couples counseling isn't going to work when somebody is not acknowledging that or dealing with that. And so it's an unfortunate situation, but they need to go face it. And these are individuals who struggle. It's not that simple. It's not this just like, I'm feeling anxious and I want to go talk to a therapist. It's, I'm gonna go face my these deep sources of pain inside of me, and I'm probably gonna go through 3 or 4 or 5 therapists. They've probably been to therapy in the past. It didn't work. You know, they blame the therapist or the approach or whatever, and it didn't work. What's the point? You know, well, what they're doing is avoiding digging into that deep shame, and experiencing that sort of lie.
Yeah, and I remember somebody once saying that shame is like a real, like one of the heaviest emotions, one of the most difficult emotions to feel. Like how does shame apply to the, like, what does it mean in the context of your clients, shame?
Mm-hmm. I mean, shame says I am bad. I mean, guilt says I did something wrong and it was bad and I feel bad about it. But shame is actually, I am bad. And if that's my core belief, if I believe that about myself, if that's how I experience the world as I'm the sort of bad person, it's going to be haunting. I have to find a way to deal with that shame and realize that things happened to me that were out of my control. And I have to work through all that deeply, in order to be able to, you know, deal with life on life's terms. And deal with people and relationships, because otherwise everything is shrouded in shame. Every experience of my life is about shame and avoid. It's about shame avoidance. So everything I am is actually a fake version of myself that is just working to appease whatever environment I'm in, whether it's work or with friends or with my family. And family gets the brunt of it because they're the ones who see behind the mask. Everybody else has built-in boundaries socially and everything. But when I'm at home, these people are calling out the real me, and shame is coming in and shutting it down. And so then we see the strong, powerful reactions that, you know, are just shame defense.
Wow. It's funny, isn't it, how like intimate relationships push the truth of our personalities to the surface in the way that, like you say, other people may not see that down at the pub or in the high-powered workplace.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes back to that growth thing and the need for relationships to grow, because that's how we're wired. We're wired to grow. And so somebody who's experiencing shame, if they're willing to hear that that's an expected experience, that they can take this and go, I'm being triggered. And although I'm overwhelmed, see, that's the problem, is we're all being triggered. Mm. But being overwhelmed by my trigger is what I'm needing to go get the help and the therapy to work down, so I'm not reactive, so I can experience this sort of negative emotion without being reactive and essentially out of control.
Yeah.
If I can get down to that level, now I can stay in the conversation longer with somebody who is challenging me, my partner, my kids, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
I can hang in there and work through that, because I know that the shame is actually something I need to push, not deal with. It's not true.
Yeah.
It doesn't apply.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
It's almost like you teach people how to like distance themselves from the intensity of that destructive emotion that sucks you down.
Yeah. 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 And when conflict happens and people are triggered into conflict, you know, one of the things that sometimes I'll tell couples to do is like, you don't have the skills to talk about that topic this week. Like, we're gonna put it on the side. It's better off not fighting and trying to get into a conversation that you can't work yourself out of. Mm-hmm. And then experiencing collateral damage, saying things you don't mean, being hurt, and just like, let it go. We'll meet next week. We'll get back into this conversation and we'll dig it out in therapy. But sometimes people just can't avoid they're sucked into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
By their need to grow. We want conflict. We need conflict. We need the stress to grow. And so, you know, how do we approach it?
You know, you spoke about lots of these words we hear, like narcissism, codependency. Something I've always found quite triggering is like, you know, you need to love yourself first to be in a relationship. And of course, that's important to a degree. But as you said, like, we're all dealing with our own stuff to a degree. So you need to have the shame. There might be an innate thought of, I am bad. So like, where to, like, if you're in a relationship and one party is like, I'm a piece of shit, I'm bad, like, can that even work in a relationship? Like, what point do you need to get to? What would the inner monologue of that shamed person need to get to have a successful relationship?
Yeah, I mean, they would need to articulate that they're, you know, again, people can feel shamed. We all have parts of us that we're not sort of happy about and things like that. But when my whole identity is shame and my whole positive experience is based off things being a certain way in my environment, me controlling the environment, me controlling the experiences of my life, if that's, then I'm going to, things are going to fall apart and I'm going to be exposed anyways. That person's internal dialogue has to change to understanding, I guess, with a level of self-awareness, what I'm experiencing is not about this person. I have to stop projecting. Mm-hmm. But again, the intensity of the reaction has to come down. And a lot of that has to do with coping. It has to do with me learning to regulate my own emotions from a physical standpoint. That's why in trauma therapy, it's always going to be the first thing you're teaching is coping. Mm-hmm. You don't just go into processing because processing is going to be too overwhelming for a person who can't cope. Mm-hmm. They're going to be triggered and activated and they need to work through that. So they have to learn to cope and breathe and meditate and pray and do yoga and all these other things while they, to prepare themselves for when they do feel experience, when they experience the overwhelming sensations of trauma.
Gosh. And when people do experience overwhelming sensations of trauma, obviously some people have never been around that. Like, what comes up? Like, what are you seeing if someone's really dysregulated?
You see very much overreactions. You see people getting upset about little things in the environment being out of place. Again, typically when I'm dealing with like couples, it's, you know, the house has to be perfectly ordered and clean. Mm-hmm. And when it's not, it's like my whole world is falling apart and I'm upset and I'm mad because you left this mess or that mess. It's not something simple. You see a lot of shutdown. Like, I can't talk to you right now. And so they won't talk for hours or even sometimes days because of that reaction. You see the snap reactions towards their kids. They yell. They're big yellers and justifying the yelling behind the scenes. They are warranted to behave the way they're behaving because how they feel is real to them.
Right.
It feels like an eight to me. Therefore, it is. Even though it makes absolutely no sense that your child is not trying to hurt you. But yet you're reacting to that child as if they are hurting you, and you're justified to react that way. And if they would just listen, if they would just do what they're told, or you know, then I wouldn't be mad.
Right.
And that's the kind of reaction that you get. It's just like, well, that's your problem. They don't care. They can't engage empathetically, because that would be to open themselves up vulnerably to be empathetic to somebody else's feelings. So they seem to not care.
Yeah.
About your feelings or your concerns.
So beautifully expressed, Ryan. And then, of course, as you said, they're projecting that stuff, say, onto like a 5-year-old who can't rationalize that this isn't about me. Daddy's just got unhealed stuff. And then, of course, they carry that shame as adults, don't they? Because they're like, I'm worthless. Daddy's screaming at me saying I'm whatever.
Right. I'm drawing my identity from my environment as a child. I can't escape that environment. I don't think for myself. I don't have that brain online yet. And so I'm actually drawing my value from the love and consistency of that love that I get from my parents.
Yeah.
And if it's inconsistent or it's overbearing or not there, my entire egocentric system is going, what's wrong with me? It's never going to go, what's wrong with mom or dad, or mom's just having a bad day. You know, a 7-year-old shouldn't be saying mom's just having a bad day.
Right.
That kid's got going to have some issues, and there's some out there. But no, that's what ends up happening in those families is that 7-year-old goes, I'm bad. What's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. What's wrong with me? And then they script an entire set of rules as they get engaged socially through junior high and high school. They sort of engage rules that avoid the experience of that I'm bad experience.
Yeah.
And act in sort of false ways.
When you say act in false ways, what do you mean?
Ways that aren't true to yourself, right? Ways that are going to, at some point in time, be woken up by real intimate relationships when they come into your life. Mm-hmm. That's when the real self is going to come up, the things that you avoided and that weren't brought out in you. I mean, a way to look at it would be, you know, healthy parenting isn't driving a kid to do what I want you to do necessarily. I mean, there are certain things that we want to push our kids to do as best as possible, but you want to identify in your child what's their personality? What are their interests? Where is that showing? If you have a really creative kid and you make them, you know, keep their room spotless all the time and they, you know, you control how they play, you're going to have somebody who's going to be, you're going to disrupt that child's development. There's things how many times I've heard people say, you know, I always wanted to play guitar, but my parents, you know, my dad wouldn't let me.
Yeah.
My parents wouldn't let me do this, or I wanted to do this, my parents wouldn't let me do that. And it wasn't so much about doing that, it was more of the suppression of that identifying piece of me that was coming out in the environment that wasn't welcome. My environment didn't welcome parts of me, so I shut that part down.
Wow.
But it's still there. It's dormant. It's in the basement. And
wow.
I put on a mask and I create an identity, a persona that is working for me as best as possible in my environment. Mm-hmm. So I'm placating to my environment and my environment's not welcoming me.
Gosh, it's scary because we hear that so much, don't we? You know, parents telling you can do that, you can't do this, whether it's career or otherwise. It's very common. It's quite a horrifying thought.
Yeah.
And so essentially people sort of mask, they haven't really discovered who they are because they've been so controlled. So then they develop coping mechanisms, masking to please others and to fit in. And I guess, is that where the sort of fractures, that's sort of where the fractures are in a way?
Yeah, because the parts of me, you know, and this is true for all of us, but there's parts of me that again are sort of dormant or I don't bring out because I'm afraid of how it's going to be received in the environment. And, you know, what I need to do is learn to integrate those parts of me into my identity. So I'm not just this sort of having this persona of who I think I am, but this real part of me inside of me is able to come out and express itself and become part of my identity. We all have hidden parts of us, you know, that people call out, oh, you're really good at this, or you should do this, or you should do that. And it's like, yeah, you know, maybe, but I don't necessarily believe it. And then maybe I get an opportunity to do it, and I do it, and then get this feedback that says, oh, wait, I actually can do that. I am good at that, or that is something I could possibly see or do in my life. And, you know,
absolutely.
It's probably why people are so missing the mark when it comes to trying to find a career path. You see that all the time, right? It's like, I don't know what I want to do.
Totally.
I mean, yeah.
And I quite often hear, I mean, I'm not a therapist, but, oh, well, dad told me this, or I did this to please dad. So much of it does come back to parenting, or even like really high powered people. I mean, I'm talking like geneticists or whatever, who struggle to use their voice in meetings. All comes back to childhood, because they were hushed away at the dinner table and they listened to the brother more than maybe my client. So it's quite scary, the power that parents wield, isn't it? It's terrifying, actually, because we aren't given classes on this stuff, are we? Like, we so need classes on this stuff. Otherwise, you know, when you were talking about the dad, you know, who's got unresolved issues, sort of shaming the child. As you were saying that, I had this really powerful image of two children facing each other, because the dads or the mum, they're essentially just a wounded child themselves, shaping their own child, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Living vicariously through the children, or, you know, or just avoiding the intimacy required to be a parent. I mean, that's the other thing too, is your kids are going to wake up inside of you, your trauma too, and your own issues.
Yeah.
You know, what is it I'm trying to do here? But I don't see that. But most people don't. And again, not everybody has to understand this stuff clinically. We're talking about individuals who are really struggling, and who have a pattern of destructive sort of relational behaviors, and families that are really in turmoil, in toxicity. They need to hear this stuff and conceptualize themselves accurately. The healthy individuals may not be great at relationships, then they learn, and we all have problems and everything, but it's a different world, you know what I mean? Like, a messy house versus a hoarder's house are two different things, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have messy houses, and they fail at that, and they don't get it together. But we're talking about people that are experiencing, like, real issues.
Yeah.
Deep issues, you know, that can't be rationalized. And the people that are healthy aren't needing all this psychobabble conversation, you know. They find ways to work through it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know. Yeah.
And Ryan, obviously you mentioned, like, obviously you're in the business of helping people work through this stuff. What sort of, because you hear all this stuff like, oh, therapy can make things worse, you're just swimming around in the negative, and then you hear other treatments like EMDR and stuff. Like, what, in your view, like, what does actually help trauma? What sort of treatments and approaches?
I mean, I think right now there's, you know, the things like EMDR, somatic experiencing, brain spotting is incredible. I have a colleague, a friend, that is very much into that, and the things I hear about that are just miraculous. It's amazing, because people can process that sort of brain injury, if you will, without having to do a lot of talking,
right?
Without having to process verbally everything, they can process and get their brain to regulate better without having to talk, and that's helpful,
right?
Because it's a lot less scary,
and it's kind of science backed. It seems like, probably, I imagine something men would relate to, because it's not just like psychobabble. It's like, is brain spotting where you sort of scan the brain and show? Is that, what is brain spotting?
I mean, brain spotting essentially, I mean, again, and I'm not fluent in this, and it's been a while, so I don't directly treat trauma people individuals for trauma anymore. Typically, but it's basically involves a similar to EMDR, where it's going to use your eye movements, and it tries to find the point. But your eyes are sort of the window into your, you know, you've heard this, window into your soul. Like, it's sort of, it's, there's a connection with the brain, and you find this point in your X and Y axis in your sight of vision, and you hold that point while you process. And what will happen is you'll find that point, and you'll be evidenced by, you know, a feeling. You'll feel it somewhere in your body. And you'll notice that the trauma comes up somewhere in your sort of body, and you hold that. And what happens after that, I'm a lot less fluent in what actually happens, so I won't go down that road. But it's a lot about finding that point in your axis and in your visual line of vision, and
That's
holding it.
Yeah, it's interesting, the relationship between the physical and the emotional, isn't it? I know you mentioned Bessel van der Kolk and his incredible book, The Body Keeps the Score. And I was reading a bit about EMDR in that, and he said that he was really skeptical about, you know, how eye movements and that sort of therapy can actually cure stuff. And he was amazed when he tried it, how powerful he found it.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, last I checked, you know, the research, again, brain spotting is newer, and it's not always easy to find somebody, you know, but it's highly touted. But EMDR has been around for a while. And last I checked, it was, I mean, this has been years, but it's for single incident trauma, it's one of the best things that's out there. It's the most effective for single incident trauma, meaning you've experienced a traumatic event in your life. Mm-hmm. The complex trauma thing is a little bit more difficult to deal with, and a little different. You know, EMDR can be applied, and it's there, and it works. It's just like brain spotting, and it's a special kind of therapy that people need to be trained in and sort of really understand what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So if you struggle with more complex trauma, like not a single event, what do you think is most helpful there?
I think you know, people that are highly reactive aren't going to do well in talk therapy, and if they recognize that they're highly reactive and they really want to get help, then going with one of the more you know, somatic experiencing or body you know, EMDR and the brain spotting type thing would be a way to be helpful, because again, if they're triggered in their personal life, they're going to come to therapy, and they should be prepared to be triggered to a certain degree there as well. Mm. And they're going to run from that. So the more reactive I am, the more volatile I am in my reactions, the more I would lean towards, you know, the EMDRs and brain spotting, because it's going to help me deal with that better right up front. So I can get to a place where maybe I can talk and understand and live with a little bit of what I've been through.
Interesting. And you probably heard of the Amen clinics in America, Dr. Amen, where they scan your brain and they show people essentially what areas of their brain have been affected by whatever mental health issues they're experiencing. And then they find holistic, lots of different holistic ways to treat people, whether it's, you know, proper tablets or other things. Is there any benefit to that kind of approach, or is that difficult to
say? I'm sure there is, you know, medically and biologically. I think that, you know, treating the body as a, you know, sort of biological, you know, treating symptoms is helpful to a certain degree. I think if you separate that, I don't know a lot of people, and again, this is where I don't deal with a lot of people who are just dealing with an organic brain issue. Everything to me is something that relates back down to relationship. Everything happens in relationship. All hurt happens in relationship. All healing happens in relationship. And so, you know, I'm medical intervention is going to be my last line of defense. And for those that do, you know what I mean? And unless you need it, some people need it, you know, people that are really dealing with real bipolar, they need medical intervention. People that are dealing with real, you know, with real schizophrenia and things like that, they need medical intervention. You know, we would get into a little bit of a place where, you know, it gets a little sketchy, because it's hard to judge what somebody's depression is or somebody's anxiety is. But real anxiety, real depression, sometimes people are hiding their real relational issues and their core issues in a diagnosis. And a diagnosis for me, I find a lot is a trap, because once I identify with that diagnosis, well, that's my problem. And if I just fix this problem, then it should help everything else in my life. And I think that's less true than people think it is, because meds tend to be something people run to, and they, when they can't deal with anxiety and they can't deal with some depression, or I'm just not, you know. And again, not to ever, I'm not anybody's doctor, so I'm not, you know, anybody that would be listening to this or hearing that, it's not so much that you're, again, I'm not playing into you're weak. I think the medical model is somewhat of a trap. It's not holistic, and it doesn't deal with sort of the environmental aspects typically. It's just dealing with symptom treatment.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope, isn't it? As you say, and you said something really beautiful there, Ryan, which sounded very hopeful. You said all healing happens in relationships. What does that mean?
I mean, again, it goes back to what you're talking about with how am I relating to people? We live in a world of cycles, and sort of, you know, in couples therapy, we call it like circular causality. Things aren't linear. Things aren't like if I do this, then this happens. And we want to think that way rationally, like A plus B equals C, but it's more relational. So my environment is providing me feedback about myself all the time, mm-hmm. if I'm open to it.
Right.
And I can see where it could be that I'm having an issue, and it's a reflection of an issue with inside of me. Mm-hmm. That's what I have control over. I have control over how I respond to the environment, not the environment itself. And we'll spend a lot of time, you know, moving, changing relationships, changing jobs, escaping mm-hmm. things that are actually telling us about ourselves. And what we find out is that we're actually running from ourselves. And the sooner I realize that as a truth, that that's almost always true. Not that leaving and moving somewhere else and doing, you know, again, that we're getting in the weeds, but most of the time it's always going to come back to me. Mm.
Gosh.
Sometimes leaving the environment is the right thing to do, yeah. but that's going to be related to me if it is, not because it's just the environment's bad.
That was so powerful.
The work of the work experience.
You mentioned the word avoidance there, Ryan, which you'd mentioned earlier. You said something like either we choose growth or avoidance. Like what are the symptoms of avoidance that you see in clients? Like how does avoidance show up in people?
I mean, what I hear is, again, a preoccupation with the environment or with other people, or when someone's talking, when we talk, we are showing how we think. We're expressing how we think to the world. And you can hear someone talk and you hear patterns and you hear how they describe the world. And that when there's a lot of emphasis on, again, environmental factors, meaning everything outside of me, when I'm emphasizing that, I know that person is sort of trying to find themselves outside of themselves, and that's not where they're going to find it.
Right. Okay. Makes
sense. So now we're going to draw attention back to that and to what does that say? What does that say about you? Mm. Let's understand ourselves a little bit better in relationship to this, or else we're going to spend our whole entire life just trying to manipulate environments to feel better.
Yeah, exactly.
Or to feel a sense of satisfaction and identity.
Yeah. And you mentioned, obviously, earlier on, you mentioned, like, poor parenting, effectively, and you mentioned somewhere on the scale, problem drinking. Like, how does that impact children, and how can that feed trauma? And, like, how do you know if you're a problem drinker?
Yeah, I mean, I think problem drinking becomes, you know, evident. Substance use in general becomes an evident issue because, again, it's like I'm not able to be present. I'm not there for my kids. I need to be. I'm drinking. It's not even my real personality. I'm not dealing with my own issues. Those individuals tend to be on that sort of narcissistic side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. It's about them and their coping, their dealing, and their processing and their own feelings so much so that they can't be available to other people. Mm. I think there's a lot more personality issues and underlying issues that problem drinking is an expression of. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that drinking is my problem. It's that drinking is an expression of my problem. Mm-hmm. And if I can get inside that and look at that, I can and question my relationship to alcohol or whatever it is that I'm doing. I have to be willing to question my relationship to that. Mm-hmm. And even if I think I have a positive relationship to alcohol, some people do. I'm a social drinker. I do this. I do that. It's like, well, but why am I really drinking? Like, what's my real reason? And it can't just be, well, because I like it. People, why? Like you can't escape that. You can't say that you do something without having it relate back to you. And if you don't want to go there, well, then that's the issue. But I think there's always something there. People will say to me, Ryan, it's not that deep. And I'm like, no, it is that deep. Do I need to live on that deep level all day long? No, we need to have fun sometimes. But these things aren't little, and it is that deep.
Right. It's almost like the theme of truth is key. Like, you got to confront the truth to get anywhere, haven't you? And if you keep living in denial, you're not going to get anywhere. You can't grow if you're just going to...
Right.
Sometimes there's a need to ask why, isn't there? If it's causing dysfunction in your life and your relationships.
It's causing dysfunction. Otherwise, you know, again, we don't need to live life questioning everything.
Yeah.
You know, some things are okay and fun and, like, you know, relax and, you know, take time out and do things that are fun and everything else. Not everything has to be the deep meaning thing, but everything should kind of be understood. Everything's telling me about myself.
Absolutely. And that was quite powerful because I feel like when you're talking about alcohol, because it's really glamorized in our society, boozing, and I think especially high functioning alcoholism can be imperceptible to others, can't it? And it interested me what you said about, like, if you say have an alcoholic parent, they're not really present. Like, do you even know their real personality? Like, how does that affect a child? If say their mum or dad is an alcoholic, Like, yeah, how does that affect their development?
Well, you're going to have a very self-centered parent. And so my childhood is going to be really largely designed. I'm going to find that one of two directions. I'm either going to just like say, forget it. And I'm going to distance myself from my family and be gone and like, just be gone and move a 1,000 miles away, or I'm going to become really codependent because everything in that household revolves around that one parent and their issue. So in other words, when the starting point of my family dynamic is one person's issue and we're all organizing ourselves around that, then everything about me is relating to that person's issue. That's the problem. So that kid's, you know, that parent needs to, what do you say? You can't, again, they have an issue that they're avoiding. Alcohol is always sort of an avoidance of something, an avoidance of discomfort.
Absolutely. And I mean, this might seems like a stupid question, but how can, like, let's say you like drinking, how would someone know that they maybe were in addiction territory versus, like you say, like social drinking or whatever else you want to call it? Like, what are the telltale signs?
People are telling them that they have a problem. People are questioning their behavior. You know, they're drinking every single day, quantity, you know, increased tolerance over time. Where I need more to get the same effect, drinking in situations where I normally wouldn't, where it's not socially appropriate, you know, but, most of the time, you know, it's going to come from people that are telling you, hey, I think you got an issue.
Right. Okay. That's a good
social world's not going to tell you that. Your friends aren't going to tell you that. They're at the bar with you. They're hanging out, having a good time. But your family might question that.
Yeah. And thanks, Ryan. That's helpful. And when you said, you know, obviously, like you said, trauma can show up in relationships with like disproportionate reactions to small things like going to the gym. And you're just like, what the hell? Why are you so upset about that? It doesn't make sense. What other signs and symptoms might show someone that they're struggling with trauma? Like, is there anything else like insomnia or anything else like that might be helpful for people to identify with?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of times our physical body. So, you know, let's start with that. Like, you know, chronic back pain, neck pain, stress like that. Like, you know, there's those things are living in the body. The body keeps a score. It's a real thing. I mean, it really is in the body, and our bodies will manifest that stuff. And so sometimes I might have like a weight issue and my weight issue is, yeah, go to the gym and watch my diet, but it's helpful to understand, like, again, from a psychological perspective, why do I struggle with sort of binge eating? Why is my gym routine so inconsistent? You know what I mean? When I understand that what I'm really trying to overcome is not just lose weight, it's really this deeper inner this identity thing that I'm trying to deal with. When I realize that, maybe I'm more motivated to carry on, and now I have a real reason to carry through with something. So the physical body is obviously there. You know, the headaches, migraines, not being able to sleep. A lot of people that have experienced trauma that I see, they consider themselves night owls. It's just how I am. You know, I'm fine on 4 hours of sleep, and it's like, yeah, maybe, probably not.
Right.
You know, probably not. But they're wired a certain way, and they just a lot of anxiety, a lot of avoidance of certain situations that shouldn't be avoidant. You know, birthday parties, family events, things that you would normally enjoy.
Is there any, you know, sometimes people say if you're sort of in trauma mode, being around other people can be quite triggering. Is there also that thing where people are sort of slightly lonery, like they just avoid people. They need to spend more time alone to be able to survive more day to day.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, that's not, obviously there are personalities, there are levels of extroversion, right? So people in their personality just have a less of a need, but everybody has a need. Everybody has a need for social engagement and relationship intimacy. That's part of just being a human being. So those that are really super avoidant, who don't seem to have any friends, the real, you know, are on the surface. Everything is through business contacts and work relationships. Their family's very distant. You know, that's a sign that there's some unresolved trauma. But the avoidance is that I'm. Again, if I'm experiencing trauma, I've dealt with the core issue is sort of I'm out of control. I can't keep myself safe. My fight or flight system didn't work to help me when I was younger. Now I don't feel like the world is a safe place. So I'm doing so much work in my brain as an individual who's experienced trauma. I'm doing so much work to hold up reality, and it's exhausting for them. Absolutely. Emotionally. So going into social situations, they're not relaxing necessarily.
God, it sounds awful.
Yeah.
Sounds like a job in itself, and you know, wearing those masks. And talking of jobs, Ryan, for just from your background, obviously you meet a lot of different, I'm sure, very interesting people. Like, what kind of personality profiles are there? You know, can you have a really successful job and be going through this level of trauma daily behind the scenes? Like, what kind of people struggle with this stuff? What kind of jobs are they doing?
Yeah, that's an interesting broader topic, I think, too. You know, you'll see a lot of high performing people that are like doctors, lawyers, people that work these big major hours, and they're highly successful in one area of their life, and their relationship suffers. And the idea that I'm actually maybe too successful in my job to even have a relationship is a foreign concept. It's like, well, it can't be this. I'm good over here. This is where I'm affirmed. So it's got to be the problem has to exist here in this relationship. And so that's a hard person to deal with, because it's like, what am I asking you to let go of? You know, if you want to have a relationship, this is how it's going to look. And yeah, they just can't let go of what they're into, what their job is, their career.
So does that kind of mean, like, let's say they're really high powered and really good at their job, maybe they find it quite hard to acknowledge that, like, that could potentially be a cover, or they find it hard to acknowledge that they could be really competent in one area, but there are some maybe quite deep fractures in other areas?
Yeah, I think it has to do with, you know, time and the value of relationships is diminished. So we don't realize how essential relationships are. We overemphasize career, success, self-identity, all this kind of stuff. Well, but once I have it, I have a very tangible thing. I have an income. I have a schedule. I have things that are physically I'm attached to. And this person is requiring me to let go of something. It could be simple. It could be, you know, it could be hours. It could be financial. It could be moving or taking a different job. Or it could be a lot. We don't know what that is necessarily. But the dynamic thing is true. It's that I'm attached to so many external things that bring value and identity to me. Yeah. And this person is challenging that. And I have, in order for me to have a relationship, I have to start taking my fingers off of certain things that I'm holding on to, which is then scary because, again, my identity is in those things.
Yeah.
People appreciate me and respect me and love me, and this is where I feel good about myself. And, you know, home doesn't make me feel good.
Yeah. And I guess those things give a sense of control, don't they? And therapy and all this jazz, it's vulnerability equals relinquishing control a bit.
It sure does. And I think that those job things too, it's hard because it does add value. It does help me. I do get to express myself in my career, but it has boundaries built into it that make it not that intimate. It's not as deep. And yes. Relationships go deep.
Right.
They go down to the core of who we are, and they are not about the environment at all in a lot of ways.
Gosh, that was so powerful. They go down to the root of who we are. Like, they really push identity to the truth of who you are to the surface, don't they?
Right. Yep. And the environment is just the venue. It's the venue that this all plays out in.
Yeah.
So we put so much emphasis on that, and it's like, yeah, it is, but it's relationships are, I mean, they're everything. Everything. And
my God,
you know,
that's really powerful. Okay. Just a couple more questions, if that's all right, Ryan.
Sure. Cool. Yep.
You mentioned then that the word attachment, and I've been meaning to ask you about, you know, attachment style. So if someone's been through trauma, like, how might that show up in their attachment style? And for people who don't know what attachment style is, what would you say?
I mean, attachment style is essentially how we you know, how we attach to people. But essentially, how we attach to people is evident in how we relate to them ongoing. So when we attach to somebody, there's a pattern in that relationship automatically that is activated. And people that are, you know, anxious avoidant, or somebody who is just flat out avoidant. I mean, there's, you know, people can get online and take tests and find out what their attachment style is. That can be helpful. But again, my approach is more to go from that growth area. What are you trying to, what is how you're reacting to this relationship telling you about your own need to grow?
Yeah.
Now let's change let's approach your need to grow in the relationship, as opposed to approaching the relationship as a solution. In other words, your relationship is probably not your problem. It's probably you. individually.
Yes.
And the relationship is just showing you that. And
Exactly.
that's,
Again, it's a venue, as you put it very eloquently. Exactly. Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of the book Attached. I found that very interesting on the on attachment styles. I guess the last major question, Ryan, I wanted to ask, you mentioned the N-word, narcissism. What does that mean? Because, like you say, we hear it a lot. And how does it relate to trauma,
I mean,
if at all?
it's scary. I mean, narcissism is, real narcissistic personality disorder is somebody who literally is, they're void of empathy. They put on they're identified by masks. So their core issue again is this need to control everything and everybody around me. You're either serving my purposes or you're an enemy. You're somebody I can't deal with because you have the potential to expose me. And so it's all control. It's all gaslighting. It's all manipulation. And you see a lot of that with that. On the same token, it's not likely, and people see this, they see the spectrum. People that are looking for answers in their relationship problems come across this narcissism stuff, and it's overused. And people are, yes, is there a sort of a spectrum? Yes, there is. But real NPD versus somebody who has sort of the lean or the tendency to be more about themselves and not seem to care or be aware that you even have needs. That person might not be a narcissist. That will show up in their willingness to sit down and try and understand and adjust themselves. A narcissist won't adjust themselves. They will just discard you or make you comply. And the person who just leans that way will go, wait, hold on, I don't even understand that. Tell me more about that. And then, oh, okay, yeah, sure. That's different. But people can see that kind of behavior and go, well, they don't even care about me. They don't have empathy. They don't, and they'll hear this they'll watch videos and they'll see this and they'll go, yeah, I think I'm with a narcissist, or I think I'm really codependent. And they don't know what to do with that language because it's just a help. It's a guide, it's a direction. But these diagnoses are just directional. They help us just kind of hone in on, well, what are we talking about? But we still got to get down to the nitty-gritty of it. Nobody's beyond redemption. You're not just, oh, I'm a codependent, or oh, I'm a narcissist. This is my, which first of all, you wouldn't admit anyways if you were. But it's like, yeah, you have to kind of start with some kind of, like, I guess, conceptualization of what is this category? How does the word help me help myself? How does this word help me talk to somebody else about it?
Like as a
But
vi- yeah.
beyond that, beyond that, it might not be that helpful to get
Right.
in that world.
Labels can be quite unhelpful, can't they? They can be very stigmatizing as well, which is cool, great. Who wants to be called a narcissist? And the sad thing is, Ryan, it strikes me that, narcissists are obviously they're often victims of abuse. It's just a really sad cycle, isn't it? But it can be, there is hope out there, I mean, your evidence of that when you talk about the complexity of trauma, you make it very manageable to understand, but it is like a minefield, isn't it? And it's so wonderful that people like you exist who can guide people through this minefield and help them with some tools, just to function more effectively on their own and with others in a relationship.
Well, I mean, thank you for that. Yeah, I think that I really wish that it was that the narcissists were the ones that were getting help, but it really is the codependents and the people who are trying to work with something that's almost unreal. It's almost like living in a twilight zone once you wake up to it. And if you're, if you're willing to take the courage to identify what's going on, you can step out of it. But real, the I think it's I think our culture is producing more of it. And yes, it is childhood trauma to a certain degree. I think a lot of what happens between the, I've read in some literature that it's basically 0 to 4. And that's why it's so hard for that person to even understand, like, see themselves, because it happened at
Totally.
such a pre-verbal age, that they can't see themselves
Of
as anything
course.
other than what they want to see.
Right. Like maybe they've never even known themselves. I saw something online recently that said, trauma can start like in the uterus, surrounded by a stress hormone. If, say, your mother is being abused by the father, great. Yeah, it's very sad, isn't it?
Very sad.
So Ryan, if people wanted to read, what books would you recommend on trauma? I mean, light reading on trauma. What are your favorites that you'd recommend if someone wants to start looking into it?
I think that, the best book out there to conceptualize, and I think a lot of clients have just come into my office saying, have you ever read this book? I mean, they find it on their own, is The Body Keeps a Score. I think that's probably one of the best and easiest books, he does such a good job of explaining things, and people can identify themselves, and he kind of covers a lot of the spectrum of traumatic experiences. Healing is a Healing Complex Trauma by Pete Walker is another really good book that's written in sort of layman's terms. It's been around for a while, but it's a really good book that is easy to understand. Mm-hmm. I think it's a big book, but it's easy to understand. So I'd recommend those two books.
Brilliant, thanks, Ryan. And Ryan, if people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
Honestly, my website, Monitoring Days, are kind of over. They can find me on Instagram. They can find me on Facebook, just as Ryan J. Breen on Instagram.
And that's Breen, isn't it?
Yeah, Breen. They can find my Medium account. That's probably a good place to connect. Yeah. Is on Medium.
And then I get to read your amazing articles like I did. I was like mind blown by that article on trauma. I'll have to link it below this podcast because it was absolutely superb. Yeah, it's brilliant. So Ryan,
thank you.
One of the final questions I always ask interviewees is, what's your definition of success?
Well, man, that's really changed for me over time. I'm not necessarily a goal-driven individual, but I do think that success is really found by finding out, you know, again, we've talked a lot about this, so I don't want to overdo it, but it's really, my success is found in knowing that I'm engaging in a lifestyle that is actually producing the reciprocal growth inside of myself. It's really understanding who I am, again, in number one, in the eyes, and I'm a faith person, so understanding who I am in relationship to God, finding myself in that sort of position of humility, openness to receive growth, and then looking at my relationships as sort of a microscope into my own needs, my own issues, and once I begin to engage the environment in relationship to my issues, I find myself experiencing life on a much deeper level, and I find myself experiencing the growth that my body's looking for, and that's not dependent on anything circumstantially working out or not working out. In other words, my peace is not dependent on how things are working out. It's based on my growth, number one, and my connection to God, but my attention to growth in the environment.
Yeah.
And when things get disrupted, I automatically look and question myself first, and then the other parties. And again, constantly seeing that, wow, this situation is waking up inside of me a need to grow. I didn't know until about 2 years ago how much pride I was dealing with in life. Mm. And I found relationships. I when I was open to that, I started seeing how that was showing up before. And I'm like, okay, now I see that happening. Let me deal with that.
Yeah.
But again, it's being in process that is success to me, being in the process. Amazing. And the results take care of themselves.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I know in another chat we had, you spoke about the same thing, like the theme of growth, like success in a relationship isn't necessarily whether you stay together. Success is all about your own personal growth. And I thought that was profoundly thought-provoking. You know, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Ryan.
That was... Yeah, because a healthy relationship is where two people are doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, yes, it sounds wonderful.
Two people are both doing that. And yeah, not, if one person's doing it, well, you'll grow, but you'll outgrow the relationship.
Exactly. You know. Yeah. Personal development is a very desirable quality in a mate, I think I've learned over the course of time.
Yeah. Yeah,
good attitude to that.
I think so.
That was so fascinating, Ryan. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That was brilliant. Thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. My pleasure. It was fun. Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed learning so much good stuff from Ryan, as I did. He's so good at deconstructing the complex. And the final giveaway to mention is I'm providing a special discount on career and life coaching sessions for the next month. So if you're confused about your career, feeling a bit down, not sure if there's an issue, but keen to find out or keen to uplevel your life in any way, get in touch at www.melanie-pritchard.com.